I hear people talking right about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countryland, they're walking on the fight beside me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting and fought die to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Guy who claims he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking down with life, I'm fighting in a fought-and-died key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting in a fought-and-died key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be warned. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Lots to talk about tonight, and going to play something that you may find very helpful, and this is from Radio Free South Africa. This is a show I did a couple weeks back, and the main organizer of this is Karen Smith. She's helped me when I took my two trips to South Africa. She made a lot of the arrangements for me, people to see, and she's a former Rhodesian. She's former Rhodesian, and then moved to South Africa, and then has now in the United States, and she's done a great deal to try to get the plight of people in South Africa far better known than it has been in North America and in other places. And I think she's had quite a good deal of success. This is a show I did with her, but primarily with her co-host, Shock van der Merwe. And this was a couple of weeks ago. And This is the show. Now, or at least we're going to play a good deal of it for you tonight, I hope.
Log Talk Radio. Vir gans en vir moord en vir ruim. Ek smog vir die bad news, vir Zuma en sy views, van ons op TV moet kyk. Ek wil nie meer hoor hoe ons tieners begrawe, oor niemand hul steur aan die wet. Ek wil nie meer lees van affirmative action, op die klei om te hou wat ek het. Geef vir my een nieuw begin, een groot soep plezier en een tellerij, wat lief die zin en kruin en sy, voor die mooi van ons land en ons recht om hier te gaan blij. Ek stiek vir my lema, sy leens en sy stem maar, ons hou maar ons mond en betaal. Kruip weg in kampe, voor klint vir die rampe, en bid dat die Heer ons omhaal. Daar's Winnie Mandela, wat mense verbrand het, maar nou wil sy huil in haar hand. Die staatskas is leeg en die ANC jeugd saai verwoesting en pijn hier ons land. Gee vir my een nieuwe gij, een voorste plezier en een wat lief die sing en skryf en skryf voor die mooi van ons land en ons recht om hier te gaan bly. Waar sy kinders, sy kinders kan bly. Maar sy huis en sy lande is nou in die hande van die vijand teen wie hy moest stry. Ons kinders verstaan nie waar bommel vandaan nie, al erfenis is uitgewis. Geen volkslied of vlag nie en geen ere wag nie vir die helde wat daar nie meer is. Geef vir my een nieuwe gij, een grootste plezier en een tellerij, wat lief die zin en skryf en skryf, voor die mooi van ons land en ons recht om hier te gaan blij. Geef vir my een nieuwe gij, een grootste plezier en een tellerij, wat lief die zin en skryf en skryf, voor die mooi van ons land.
You're listening to Radio Free South Africa with Corinne Smith on ResolutionRDO.com. Call in or listen now at 607-203-5423. That's 607-203-5423.
Welcome to Radio Free South Africa with your hosts, Skulk Rondemava and Karen Smith. Tonight we are very, very honored to have as our guest Paul Frederick Fromm. Paul is a great friend of white South Africans. You've all heard of the trips that journalists have taken to South Africa to do a fact-finding missions of their own, But I really think that Paul was probably one of the original people that went there, because it was 3 or 4 years ago that I had the honor to be introduced to Paul and to be able to help plan his itinerary when he went to South Africa to find out for himself and for the American Freedom Party exactly what was happening in South Africa. Because having spoken to many of the show hosts on from the American Freedom Party and Ken Gibbardon, who was running for president on their behalf at that time, they were shocked and could not believe what I had been telling them and saying about South Africa. So they raised the money. Paul paid a large amount out of his own pocket, and he went to South Africa, visited the squatter camps, visited the war memorials, interviewed people who were survivors of the farm attacks. So he knows firsthand what has happened in South Africa. So it's a great honor to have him back on the show. So without further ado, good evening, Skulk.
Good evening, Karen, and how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. And good evening, Paul.
Good evening, Skulk and Karen. It is a great honor to be back on this show, and I know we have a lot to talk about.
Well, Skulk, I'm handing it over to you, because you particularly were pleased to have Paul on the show.
Oh, yes, definitely, Karen. It's quite exciting to have one of my big heroes and one of those people that I've always looked up to as a guiding light of conservatism and our way of thinking, if you want to call it that. So it's a great honor and privilege to have Mr. Fromm on the show and to interview him and have this conversation. So thank you very much, Mr. Fromm, for making yourself available. And yes, for you to avail yourself to the South African and the American and the Canadian people to have listened to what we have to say tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure being here.
Let's kick off at the simple.
Very shortly, your background. I know you very well. You don't
know me, but I know you very well from video work and from Stormfront and the things that you write and the articles and so forth. But many of our listeners will not really know where to place you, especially the South African listeners. Can you give us a little bit of background to where you fit into the political spectrum?
Yes. Well, I have two big issues when I introduce myself to new people. I say I have two big issues, immigration and free speech. Too much immigration and not enough free speech. And that has been a particular focus on Canada, but you could say the same thing about all of Europe and about the United States as well. So my big issue in terms of immigration is to prevent the European founding settler people of Canada and the United States from becoming a minority. And we will be, with current immigration levels, we'll be a minority in the United States by 2040 or 2041 in Canada, just before the turn of the century, the middle of the century, just before 2050. This is not because we lost a war or a foreign power invaded us and took us over. It is because of treachery and treason from the very top, for a variety of reasons, some not very some understandable but not very creditable, for instance just plain greed, the desire for cheap labor. In other cases, absolutely sinister, the strong dislike on the part of certain people of us of European people, and the desire that we should be replaced. In fact, there's one American psychologist writer who called the white race, calls for the suicide of the white race, and of course the late Susan Sontag called our race the cancer history. Well, we are not. We are probably the greatest benefactors mankind has ever had. And not only should we not go out of existence, but we should continue to prevail in our homelands. And I might add, if I might jump the gun a bit, as the white tribe in South Africa was there just before, and certainly no later than the Bantus moving south, South Africa, I see, as part of the
European world. I don't want to see my fellow Europeans, dispossessed on the other African continent. So that's the immigration side. And the free speech side is it's difficult to promote these ideas if you're not allowed to speak about them. And throughout the West, with the possible exception of the United States, we face legal restrictions on what can be said, especially if you get close to dangerous topics like race or ethnicity. And so we spend a lot of time up here in Canada in courts and human rights tribunals fighting these laws, assisting people who are charged or may be charged. And so that takes up my time and then some. But I do a lot of videos, as you so nicely referred to.
Yes, exactly. And it's very interesting when you go and you look up, for instance, on Wikipedia or the mass media, what is their view of all from sitting here on radio tonight. And you will read all these scary things of Ku Klux Klan and new Nazi and white supremacist, all these nasty words being thrown. But then you go and you look at the videos, and I spoke to Karen before we went on air about this tonight. You come across as just an ordinary, sane, rational person sitting there and just saying things that make sense. We're not speaking of a hard right tattooed new Nazi in Germany running around with a flag. We're speaking of a very sane and rational person just simply pointing out this is a problem and this is a problem and this is a problem, and you can't really fight the things that Paul Fromm is saying on his videos. And I think this is what makes a person like you so dangerous, and why the mass media is trying so hard to paint you into a corner, because they can't really fight the rationality of what you are saying. And here you come across, you say, this is how you start your interview, you say, I have two problems. The first one is a very simple problem, and that is immigration that has gone out of control. And it has gone out of control. And the second thing is a very liberal idea. It's not even so much a right-wing idea, and that is freedom of speech. You're an advocate of freedom of speech. Now, how do you fight those things? And I think that is what scares the bad guys so much about people like you, yourself and people like you. That is what I've found also in South Africa, then the people that is more toned down, that don't come across as very strong conservative or even right-wing. Those are the people that the mass media and the liberals, they go after you guys. So it's very interesting to see this narrative being painted around people like yourself.
Well, one of the the great breakthroughs of the past 4 years is Donald Trump, as particularly what Trump has said. He said it during the campaign. He continues to say it. He talks about the fake news media at rally after rally, the press would be in the front row, and he'd look down at them and say, "Now you in the press, you lie, you lie, you lie, you lie." And he's kept that message up, and it has, I think, created a major sea change in attitude. A lot of people who were skeptical before now have a good they have some justification to be even more skeptical. If after all, the President of the United States says that mass media tends to lie or peddle in fake news, that confirms their views. And others who might not have thought too deeply think about it. And all you have to do is to be involved in some event and then see the way it's covered in the mass media. And unless it's something as innocuous as a high school football game or baseball game, very often what is reported in the press will be unrecognizable in terms of the event. And when I was still an English instructor, there was some event that some of my students were involved in. And when they saw the write-up in the paper on Monday, they were flabbergasted. But they said, "Mr. Fromm, but that's not what happened." I said, "Well, let this be a lesson to you. Just because you see it on television or you read about it in the newspaper, don't assume that's necessarily the truth." And I come back to the Wikipedia write-up there. I haven't looked at the Wikipedia write-up for many months, but I was told a couple of years ago, have you checked Wikipedia lately? I said, no. It says there in a paragraph that although I'm a longtime friend of David Duke's and so on, I in fact have a secret side. I date black women. Well, often a good smear at least has a little smidgen of truth. But I rack my brains to think, to see, well, how that possibly could be. But anyway, it has since disappeared. But that is the type of, what makes Wikipedia mischievous is that there will be a truth there. I mean, they may get the date of my birth right, maybe even the country of birth, and some events correct. So it's also, it's every single word's a lie. But what they try to do is to assassinate you with labels. I taught journalism in addition to English writing and literature, and we always told our would-be reporters, when you cover somebody, it's your obligation to let them self-identify. So you're supposing there's a committee, and they're protesting, let's say, the building of a road, and I'm a reporter. Well, I'll go to the chairman or the president of the committee and say, well, who are you? And they might say, well, we're concerned citizens that live in this particular area. It would not be fair for me to say a group of selfish, uncaring, wealthy residents oppose the building of the road, calling them names. I always told my would-be reporters that you've got to let a person self-identify. Now, none of these people has ever come to me and said, well, how would you characterize yourself? Well, I would characterize myself as a populist, for one thing, a libertarian in many ways, and a white nationalist. I'm for my own people. That doesn't mean I mean harm to any other people. Whereas, of course, they don't stick a label on, like, for instance, I'm not sure what Wikipedia says right now, but one of the smear outfits in the United States, the Southern Poverty Law Center, mm-hmm. I think identifies me as a leading Canadian neo-Nazi. Well, that is just plain false. I have never identified myself as that, and I wouldn't, because it's like calling yourself a bubba. In the United States, a bubba is a stereotypical, stupid, backwoods guy from the South who isn't too bright and doesn't have, you know, very good manners. So you wouldn't deliberately call yourself a bubba. Well, the term Nazi, although it's widely used, was a communist term that came out of the 20s. And the communists, who were quite strong in Germany at the time, tried to smear their rivals in the German National Socialist Workers Party as Nazis. Now, that came from Ignaz, and Ignaz was your stereotypical Bavarian country bumpkin, pretty much like a bubba. So they were just kind of saying that the National Socialists were, you know, backwards, not very bright types. Well, why would anybody want to say, you know, I'm a new one of those? I have almost never in my life run across somebody who, when I ask them, well, what are you, would say, well, I'm a neo-Nazi. And usually if they do, they're either a fraud or they're just very, very naive. But that term is widely used about us and many other patriots. And it's meant to scare people, to give them, so they conjure up in their mind pretty much the image that you were talking about of a person with a skinhead with all sorts of tattoos and waving a flag.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And in South Africa, we have a very similar situation where the right-wing politics is, it's always portrayed as these stupid people, these inbred people, usually khaki-clad. The whole idea of what you're speaking of, a baba, of a country bumpkin, basically just being there because he doesn't have anything else to do. Now, to
while you're talking about that, actually, AfD, that's the alternative for Germany, or the alternative
yes.
for Deutschland. And the stereotype would be that their followers are lower class, more poorly educated, probably rural, and so on. You know, in other words, in North American terms, bubbas. In fact, they had solid support right across the class and the economic spectrum. Well-educated people as well as poorly educated people, well-off people, reasonably well-off people, and poor people all supported them in considerable numbers. So, and this, the academics who did this study were actually quite taken aback. This was not what they thought they'd find. And we still suffer from the smear that if you are nationalistic and so on, then it's because you're just not very well educated or stupid, and that's simply just not the case.
Exactly.
In fact, we just finished having a really great we sponsored a great series of talks in my country by a South African videographer, Jan Lamprecht, and he was going over the last 50 years of history, of the hidden history of Southern Africa. And he pointed out that the father of apartheid was not some country ignoramus, but was a highly educated man, Dr. Hendrik Verfurt, 26.
I can hear you on Korea.
Department, I believe it was at Stellenbosch University. I mean, we're talking about really intelligent, educated people. We should never let the enemy portray us as dummies.
Exactly, because the narrative that's always being painted in South Africa and across the world is that if you're so-called progressive or so-called liberal, then by its very nature you're now more clever than the other people, because you don't have to belong to a herd. But now it's always very interesting to me that the liberals tend to herd in their own little puddle and in their own little group. Whereas people from a conservative background, they are usually more value-based. They don't think in terms of identity so much as in terms of value. The way that you think, for instance, it goes about libertarianism, personal liberties. So it's definitely not this hard identity politics type of a thing. Identity politics is more left-wing than it will ever be right-wing. So it's very interesting how they try to portray us as these underdeveloped, very stupid, uneducated people who needs to be in some group to feel strong. I'm an individualist. I don't have many friends. I see myself as a Boer, as Afrikaner, but that's my definition. It doesn't mean that I need anybody to make me strong or be part of her to make me strong. But that is how we are being portrayed, and that's very sad, because unfortunately, I think for many years the more medium, the more centre-focused person saw the conservative people as a weird fringe, as something that you don't aspire to.
Yes.
But I think that's changing tremendously, and it's, I'm very glad that you spoke about the AfD now in Germany, because the AfD is not painting itself as a so-called right-wing or fringe party. It's painting itself as very midway, and it's gaining a lot of strength there. But you also have very far-right elements, so-called far-right elements. To me, it's not really far-right. It's just simply being patriots, also now going for the AfD. And in a way becoming more acceptable, so that they are now the I think the third largest party in the Bundestag, and they are the official opposition.
Sure.
That is how far it has moved in Germany, and Germany specifically, because Germany has the so-called Nazi history and all the bad things related to that. So it's very interesting how our politics has started to move in a direction where this is becoming acceptable. Just simply by people thinking of what is really going down and not following the mass media and the narrative being built there.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm of two minds about identity politics. I do believe that we should promote and protect our group, and our group are the, you know, broadly speaking, the Europeans. And we are under attack. I mean, you know it far better than I do in South Africa. Certainly, we are under attack in Canada and the United States and Europe from an absolutely morally bankrupt, rotten political elite. And so protecting us as a people is important. However, identity politics has also been used by the cultural Marxists to try to divide us, women against men, people on the basis of age, and so on. So they have used identity politics to try to divide us.
Yes, that's true, and we spoke about this specific subject a little bit earlier tonight also, where it becomes predictable and controllable how a population votes, because you simply divide them up in little segments and little identities, and then play off those identities against one another, so that in the United States, most black people and most Latino people will now vote Democrat because they've been played and the narrative has been created for them to fit into that. So it becomes very controllable. I agree fully with you. Yes, of course you must protect your own. Now, protecting your own is not a negative thing. It's a positive thing. But the moment that it becomes a negative thing, so that you use a group or a segment to now demonize another one, as the left is doing. We are not doing that. Then it becomes a huge problem for us. So it's very interesting, this thing of identity politics, how it's used on both sides, the one being more positive, the other more negative. You also said something that was very, not very strange, but very enlightening, and it goes about people identifying as per what the narrative is. So if you go into Germany and the person identifies himself as saying, yes, I'm a new Nazi, he's most probably a fake. He's put there to create the impression of this is what the new Nazi is supposed to be. And in South Africa, and Karen will know this very well, we see this every day where these fake right-wingers run around on Facebook and run around on Twitter and on all social media platforms creating the impression of rabid, racist, ugly people, uneducated, cursing, swearing, going on. And I can see the patterns. It's patterns of, it's organized, how they are trolling the internet and the social media to create this narrative. So it's very interesting. I'm very glad that you picked up on that, because it's not only my view of it, it's definitely yours also, and you're the authority on all these things.
I've seen that. The internet is an incredible breakthrough, but it's not without its problems. I think we would be much further behind. Certainly, we would in North America if it were not for the internet. The internet has allowed us to bring people together from around the city, across the nation, across the continent, across the world. It allows for inexpensive and almost instant communication. With the coming of things like YouTube, it allows us to be reading our television channels up to a point. The equipment necessary is relatively straightforward. We've got all sorts of great videographers putting out really high-quality material. And that's all to the good. On the other hand, of course, it allows a certain amount of anonymity, so you can be, anything you want. Beast with the Southern Cross, or Arctic warrior, or whatever brand name you want to give yourself. And you can have an online existence completely separate from reality. So that is a downside, but I think what I would like to do is to try to draw people out. The internet is great for education, but beyond that, for people who have a profile, and I try to challenge them to to join a group, to do something, to be more than just...
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, do something in real life. Go physically go to the streets. We have a movement that...
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
We physically turn up at the U.S. Embassy, of course, or the Australian Embassy, and go and try and speak and create dialogue there. So it's very... And you can immediately also see who's the keyboard warriors vis-a-vis the people that's really doing the work. And unfortunately, it's also so that the keyboard warriors usually have a huge, tremendously huge following, whereas the real art workers, they only have a very small number following them. But that's part of the game. That's part of that nature of the game. Mr. Fromm,
what was the name of your group?
Amongst others, we have the Black Monday movement, Black Monday South Africa movement. Let me tell you about that. Yeah, some time ago, there was a particularly horrible farm murder in the Western Cape area of South Africa, which is not really that much plagued by this farm killing disease that we have. And that caused a tremendous outcry in that community, and it spread like wildfire throughout the country. And on a given Monday, many people literally went to the streets and blocked off roads and wore black and so forth. So it became a popular movement called Black Monday. Nobody really planned it. We had a little bit of organization behind the scenes, but yes, it wasn't that big of an organized as it was a popular movement. But then we took that concept, myself and certain other people, and we created a formal movement, and it's called Black Monday South Africa Movement. And we keep on this theme of Black Monday. Every 3 months we have a little rally. Whoever wants to join can join. So we keep that alive. So yeah, we're actually doing we're doing the footwork. We're doing the footwork. Very closely allied to the Black Monday movement is the party of which I'm the leader of, the National Conservative Party. It was established in 2016, and it says exactly what it is. It's a nationalist conservative party, which makes us pretty much a first in South Africa after the old National Party of let's say in the 1950s and 60s. Where we very clearly say we have only one
passion.
We did not contest these elections. There were a host of reasons, amongst others, that we were being stifled by the media. But then in 2.5 years from now, on the local elections takes place, and we will definitely contest in those, because then it becomes easy. You go into the areas that's concentrated white, and you go and put your candidate in those areas, like yourself. You did the election of a mayor, I think, of Hamilton.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Municipal area and try to win the vote there, because running on a national level against a party like the DA, they have a budget in South African terms of nearly 400 million rand to spend on an election. We had about 20 or 30,000 rand. So you can never...
Well, I had one running, but you won't have to call me Your Honor. I didn't win.
Well, you made a point. You stood
and you made good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
It's also necessary that people realize our politics, South African politics, is designed in such a way that a white person can never win an election. That's impossible. We are 8%. The white population is 8% of the population. Registered voters, we are a little bit more, because there's more white people registered to vote percentage-wise as black people, but it's still such a small percentage that even if all the white people go and vote for exactly the same party, it's still a very small minority in parliament. So we're sitting with that practical problem in South Africa. But yes, we're doing the footwork, and that's very necessary to show to people it must be done in real terms also. It can't only be done on media platforms. It must be done in real terms. And I think that is where the Germans are really leading the way now. And not only the Germans, across Europe. Front National, they have a new name now, Marine Le Pen's party. those people, they literally went to the streets. The Yellow Vest movement in France now, people actually going onto the streets and showing their discontent and showing their resistance. I think that is so, so necessary to overcome the predicament that we're in now.
You have to move beyond the internet can be good for education, and that's very important. It can be also good, I think, for networking and for breaking down the isolation, which is one of the things that the cultural Marxists have imposed upon us by trying to marginalize us. But we have to go beyond that. If we're going to retake our countries, we have to have activism, and some of that will be actual political activism, or as you're saying, taking to the streets. It's got to be more than just liking something, with a check mark or whatever on the internet.
Yes, exactly. I want you to guide us around the issue of free speech, because South Africa has been quite liberal up to now, liberal not in negative sense, but liberal relating to free speech. We don't have actual laws now stopping free speech, although it's already filtering through. We have a Human Rights Commission that's obviously not in favor of conservatives, but now they are proposing actual legislation to stop free speech, so-called paid speech legislation like you would find everywhere now across the world. How do we deal with that? How do we fight the moral battle, but also the intellectual battle to show to people what we are doing is not hate speech, it's just simply us exercising our right to free speech. How do we deal with that problem, and specifically in practical terms, how do we do that?
Well, for one thing, recognize that any attack on freedom of speech has to be fought absolutely fanatically, because what we have seen in Europe and in Canada is an erosion. And I've been in this battle a long time, and I have seen the erosion. For instance, in the 80s, when our Canadian Association for Free Expression got going, when people might be proposing restrictions on free speech, they usually go something like this. Now, I'm in favor of free speech.
Paul Fromm here. We're going to talk about how the Jews created the Nazi Party in Canada.
There isn't necessarily even that free speech is not you'll hear people say that, especially younger people being more thoroughly brainwashed. This is something that absolutely has to be fought. If we had been more successful in the late 60s and early 70s in stopping free speech, anti-free speech legislation, we would not have had the battles that we have had over the past four decades. It has to be absolutely non-negotiable. The only limitations on speech should be libel, false advertising, like should not be able to label a container of arsenic as sugar or something, direct incitement to break the law. So if I say, look, pick up sticks or whatever and go and beat that crippled guy up and kill him because we don't need any more crippled people or something like that. Okay, but that's already covered in most judicial systems as an incitement to commit a crime. So another way of approaching it is we need the maximum amount of discussion, debate, is a great safety valve in a society. Where you have repression, a severe repression on speech, if somebody feels strongly, he thinks, well, look, if I write a pamphlet, well, I might go to jail. Well, if I'm going to go to jail, I may as well go and do something more dramatic, which probably means violence. Free speech isn't just a matter of tactics. Free speech, in my opinion, is a basic human right that I have because I am being created by God. That is one of my human rights. If I have the right to think, I must have the right to speak. And so does everybody else. And I think that's the level we have to fight it at. We have to fight it almost from the beginning by saying this is not negotiable. Freedom of speech is an absolutely essential human right. It is at least as important as the right to vote. What does the right to vote matter if we don't know what the candidates stand for, and if they're controversial, they're not allowed to speak. In fact, I was on another show earlier today, and I brought to their attention a news story out of Breitbart just from yesterday, I think. Facebook has shut down 23, I think, Facebook pages in Italy that in one way or another support the right-wing party or the nationalist party called La Norte. That's the party of the co-prime minister Salvini. And just 2 weeks before the elections for the European Parliament, these pages are being shut down. Well, that's a good example of exactly what should not be done. To have an informed electorate, we have to have more speech, not less. So it's something I would strongly urge you and your associates to fight with everything you can.
Yes. We've seen that actually this week and the week before in South Africa also, there's been a tremendous clampdown on all known so-called right-wingers and so-called conservatives. For instance, I was blocked for about 7 days. I can't even remember the post. It was some insignificant thing I posted a couple of years ago. And all of a sudden, I'm being blocked off using Facebook. Some of my colleagues, the last 2 days, they've also been blocked. So there's a tremendous clampdown all of a sudden on free speech on Facebook as a medium. Twitter, of course, is notorious in South Africa. I don't know if your experience is the same in Canada and North America, but on Twitter you can basically not say anything and then you're banned all of a sudden. And they sort of ban you permanently off Twitter, not like Facebook will do for 7 days or 30 days or whatever. So it's very, very indicative of who is in control of those media. I always say you must look at the fruits that a tree gives to determine what kind of tree it is, and the fruits that we are seeing on social media tells us exactly what tree is behind this. It's people trying to suppress the truth. It's as simple as that. You can never get around that fact.
This is one of my pet suggestions that I'm trying to circulate as widely as possible, but the social media companies like Facebook, PayPal, Twitter, YouTube, and I'm probably leaving a few out, but are run by left liberals in Silicon Valley and are absolutely the mortal enemy of free speech. What I think we should be advocating is that when times change, and they will change, that we will remember the suppression. And Donald Trump has already talked a little bit about something along these lines, but he's saying that they should be treated like public utilities. Your electrical provider cannot shut off your electricity because you're a conservative. Or the outfit that supplies me with water cannot cut off my water because I'm a populist. Or a libertarian, or whatever. Because these are near monopolies, they should be compelled to serve everybody without discrimination. And I think that they have got to be warned that when times change, we're not going to forget that they collaborated with the efforts to suppress free speech, and their free speech may have to be to some degree, or their monopoly to make money. They're not in it because they believe in free speech or anything else. Outfits like Facebook are a huge money churner. All of us who are on Facebook are providing ourselves free of charge as a market. And Facebook has some very complicated algorithms to figure out as much as they can about each of us and say, okay, well, Paul Fromm looks like a person who likes wine, so we'll shoot some ads for wine in his direction. I mean, it's really quite amazing and quite sophisticated, but the point is, we provide the audience. Well, I don't get paid to be on Facebook and to be a possible market for somebody. Well, okay, that's from their point of view. From our point of view, yes, we will be a market, provide ourselves as a market, but we have to be granted freedom. And right now, we're more here and less there, but there's been just an orgy of bannings in the United States. A black nationalist, Reverend Minister Louis Farrakhan, was banned. Laura Loomer, who is an anti-Muslim Jewish activist, was banned. A whole lot of people were banned, and that was after the banning of white nationalists, white supremacists. Well, they said they just lumped them all together. It doesn't matter, they're all for violence. Well, as a matter of fact, very few white nationalists are for violence.
Exactly. That's very interesting that you're pointing out. I followed the issue about Louis Farrakhan, and that they actually banned him. Now, look, he's saying all these so-called anti-Semitic things. He's going and gunning at the Jews from time to time. So maybe that was the reason that they particularly had to take him off air. So that's also very interesting. But the opposite is also true. Then they also ban, like you said, the person that speaks anti-Muslim. So it becomes difficult to see what exactly the point of the whole thing is. If they were only banning the white nationalists, you can say, well, it's anti-Semitic, and that is why they are banning it, and they're scared of so-called Nazis. But it's clearly not only that. I think they're just simply scared of anybody saying anything that can cause a little bit of eruption and a little bit of trouble, and it's commercial. You're quite right. It's commercial in the sense that if you keep on bombing people with the truth, maybe you're not going to sell as many products, because a person that would have bought Nike is not going to buy Nike now anymore because there's a political connotation to it. So it's very interesting how this is being played out, commercial versus free speech. But yes, of course, there's also this whole issue of politics behind it.
Yes, what I see happening is an absolutely panicked cultural Marxist elite, certainly in Europe and North America. They know that a lot of people are becoming awake and angry. Like earlier you mentioned the Yellow Vest movement, which started in France, but it spread to Canada. And we have had protests since mid-November every Saturday from 11 to 1 in cities across Canada, that people just spontaneously gather and join the Yellow Vest, and they're basically opposing the mass immigration, the loss of control of the border, a UN treaty that Canada signed that basically would encourage the government to suppress criticism of immigration, and there's also a domestic energy issue in Canada, which I won't go into, but what I think has absolutely shocked the political elite is that this was not just one protest once. That they could understand. If people get upset, they organize for weeks and weeks, and they have a big protest somewhere, and then that's it. They all go home and feel that they've won the war or said their piece, and they go back to sleep. But that's not what's been happening. People, and many of them who've never been involved politically before, are coming out, especially in cold weather, and waving their signs and protesting. And the elite doesn't know what to do. They spread the word that nobody should talk to the Yellow Vest because they're in the hands of the white supremacists and neo Nazis. They even mentioned me. Well, I wish I did control so many people, but I just barely get the clerk in the donut shop to give me my proper order. But that didn't work completely because there were politicians who did talk to them at their rallies, and so I see a political elite that is now, that's what we've been seeing over the past year.
It's a knee jerk. It's a knee jerk that's happening now. If you have a knee jerk, it means that you've touched a sinew in some way inside there. And I'm so glad that you bring us positive news, because to me and Karen and a lot of our guests, it seems that we've been the last outpost fighting a losing battle. But you're looking a little bit beyond. You're saying to us, well, it's you must read something more into this. It's actually the elites that are actually getting hit by what's going on, and that's really positive. And I'm glad to hear that. If you can see in Canada, because Canada is to my mind, one of the most so-called progressive countries, with that strange premier you have and all those things.
Yes,
that guy, he amazes me every day more and more. I can't believe that people will actually vote for a person like that. But anyhow, so if you are seeing it in the most progressive of societies, then we have hope. Then we have hope. In South Africa, we maybe even have hope, although we're facing tremendous problems vis-a-vis what you have still as a majority. We're a very small minority in South Africa. So it's very nice to hear these things from you.
I see that panic in the United States and in Europe as well. Like in the United States, after the big protests in Charlottesville, I think significant elements of the American cultural Marxist elite, and that we're not just talking about people who are members of the Democratic Party, I'm talking about even a number of Republicans. I think what happened was when they saw considerable numbers of presentable, mostly male, white people, you people in their late teens, 20s, early 30s, some women, but you know, mostly males, protesting and saying that they're not going to let their country be taken, be given away by immigration, and that was one of their comments. It must have been a terrible shock. They would have thought, I'm sure they thought, look, we've been brainwashing them since they were in kindergarten in a rotten education system that we largely control. Most of the churches are equally rotten. And of course the mass media is beyond rotten. Academia tends to be, very left wing and not pro European, pro white. How did these young people emerge? Look at all these young people. It isn't just a group of old geezers, in their 60s and 70s and 80s. These are young people. How did they manage to escape us? And I think that at that point they started going bananas. Taking away Goose PayPal, kicking them off Facebook, deplatforming them, striking out like a panicking political elite, and the political elite they were. And I actually see that as a very hopeful sign. And I could tell them, I could tell them, assuming they wanted to know, why people why this happened with these young people. They are educated because of the internet. There is now such a good volume of material, but particularly videos by all sorts of people, and radio shows like the one we're on right now, the one I just finished 2 hours ago, the Ethno State with William Johnson, the head of the American Freedom Party, and Ken Givedan, because I have my own daily radio show. There is so much good material out there. A young person can educate himself or herself simply by sitting at their computer. This was